Everyone's asleep. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of The Vinnie Eastwood Show. This is a Kiwi Collaborator special where we will hear from four different Kiwis from around New Zealand and around the different issues. I hope you enjoy it. Ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulous, the fluoridated, the Fukushima irradiated. We don't know how irradiated, because they stopped testing for radiation in the seawater about 6 to 8 months ago. Good on them. You know, because you wouldn't want to know that pretty much half the stuff that you're driving around in or eating or something like that has massive carcinogenic radiation, stuff like that, off of the Pacific Ocean. You know, you don't want to know that. Because, you know, you'll stop buying all of that contaminated stuff, won't you? Wouldn't that just be tragic? My very special guest is known as JP, or Joshua Perry, and I'm interviewing him today based on the New Zealand's internet party founded by Kim.com. JP, welcome to the program.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
I'm currently doing my final year of my marketing degree here at Tokyo Polytechnic. I've been studying for about 4 years. Now I'm very interested in politics, and that's why I joined the internet party.
And so, you know, after your 4 years of studying, doing your marketing degree, and getting involved in politics, what actually interests you about politics, like, today, of all days? What's going on in New Zealand right now that concerned you enough to want to join a political party?
It's the fact that all New Zealanders are now, have been fired on, and I didn't want to be fired on, so that's why I've joined the internet party to try and stop the Jesus Bible from going through. Yeah.
Okay. So you basically realised that the Government Security Communications Bureau, the GCSB, was spying on everyone, and you just don't want that to happen. Is that about right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it's as good a reason as any. I don't know about you, Josh, but I think having your privacy is akin to having your freedom. And if you no longer have any privacy, you don't have any freedom.
Exactly.
I mean, isn't that why when a child gets older, they want their own room?
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah. And I think you've got a point there. You know, it's all feeling wrong and there's nothing to be nothing time, but at the end of the day, the government can see our every move, and I think New Zealanders are concerned about that, you know? Yeah.
Well, you know, the New Zealanders should be concerned if the government knows everything that you're doing at all times when you're at home. I believe one of the interesting points made was perspective, or rather taking things out of context. Let's say, for instance, you're an activist, or you turn an activist after about 10, 20 years or something like that, in an industry, or whistleblower, and all of a sudden, every single little parking ticket, every time you weren't at home when you said you were, every little speculation, anything that could be taken out of context can be used to defame you. And the only reason they'd have all that really quite irrelevant information is because the government wants to control what people say. So if you go out and you start saying something, oh, the government's going to come after you, they'll know everything about you.
Exactly. And that's why I fear if the GCSB building is allowed to get to its full capacity, then who knows what the government will do in 10 years' time, you know?
Well, I've seen a chain with what governments do. They'll pass a bit of legislation, like you say, and then you don't know what they're going to do with it.
Yeah.
And I found what they normally do is they don't use it very much until the next government comes in, and then they use all of those powers that were set down for them by a previous political party, allegedly their rival, and say, hey, you can't blame us for using all these draconian powers and everything. We didn't pass the law.
Exactly.
Well, what direction's the country heading?
I think the country is at a crossroads right now, you know? And I think we're at a crossroads where we had to decide, do we continue down the stormy path and hope that on New Zealanders won't notice the government, or do we pull back now and get back to the way things were? Yeah.
You think we're at a crossroads, and basically people have a decision now about whether or not they want to live in a police state or not. The problem is they're not even aware that they're being given a choice.
Yeah.
They just do nothing, which is inherently choosing to be spied on in a police state.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm calling on the government to do a referendum now. When we get into power after the next election, and that's one of the first things I'll be doing when I'm elected to Parliament.
Okay, Josh, well, when you're going into Parliament for the first time and you want to, like, start a referendum, I mean, some of the things I'm really concerned about is parliamentary induction, all these rules that you have to follow, and it's almost like good apples like yourself simply jump into a banned barrel that seems to hamstring you from time to time. I've interviewed Hone Hardawera about it, and I've asked him, you know, how he could regulate the media so that they'd tell the truth and not be so full of crap all the time. And he's like, well, basically, there's bugger all you can do from inside Parliament for most things.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's just about putting walls that New Zealanders like to see in there and trying to get the best from all sides, really. Yeah.
Well, you know, if you're bringing in fresh perspectives to Parliament, it's a very good idea. If anything, it could help to water down this kind of progressive juggernaut, as I see it, happening from both the left and the right of the spectrum, who all seem to enact virtually the same legislation. It doesn't matter what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that we kind of address when I get into to power is the lack of honesty and integrity from all MPs from both sides, you know? Yeah.
Well, I thought that if the GCSB would work properly, the first thing it should surveil is all sitting MPs. to see that they're not up to dirty business in the background or whatever. I mean, if the MPs are going to pass legislation that allows them to spy on all of us, shouldn't they lead by example? Shouldn't John Key have a few CCTV cameras linked up in his bedroom, in his bathroom, in his kitchen and whatnot, so the whole country can watch him while he sleeps and goes to the bathroom?
I don't think you need to go that far, but yes, I think there needs to be some accountability and definitely some honesty, you know. I think you can definitely put cameras in each of the offices to make sure everybody's doing what they're supposed to be doing, you know.
But what happens is, and I've talked to a number of people about what surveillance does, all the way through from so-called benign sorts of surveillance, like piss testing shift workers and things of that nature, all the way to CCTV cameras in the UK. And what it does from across the spectrum is it makes people not feel like doing their job anymore. It makes them feel depressed, like they're not trusted, like they're not valued, and they can't be bothered doing it anymore, and they leave. The problem is, if it's across the entire country, you have to leave the country. And the real problem is, it's not just happening in this country, is it, Josh? It's happening everywhere.
Yeah. Well, that comes to the new world order again. Take over the rules, food supply, and I think the UN needs to take a good look at themselves, and so how can we stop this before it's too late, you know? Yeah.
Well, I think something tells me that the way this has been set up in the first place is because people take that response, you know, it's up to the people in authority, it's up to the people who are in these positions where it's their job to stop humanity being enslaved by ruthless criminal, sociopathic criminal, banking cartels or something like this in the New World Order fashion. I see a real problem with that mentality because basically it just breeds submission to authority. And that simply allows the system to keep progressing. And if I might say so, Josh, perhaps you've kind of come across as maybe an example of what people actually should be doing is running for parliament themselves. I mean, if they know about the New World Order and they can come out and speak about it, considering the importance of the subject matter, how yep. important it is for the country to stop it in its tracks... people have to take action, individually and collectively.
We have to take action now. We can't wait for tomorrow, because tomorrow is going to be too late. We have to take action now. Yeah.
Well, because another reason to take action now, I think I saw it on a website that the National Party has passed on average 2 laws per day since they got into Parliament.
Yeah, I mean, can you tell me how many laws they were passing on average when Helen Clark was in power?
It's probably something similar.
Yeah.
Which simply just shows to me that both parties have been taken over by the New World Order.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's happening, like, across the world. Yeah.
Well, it seems the Green Party as well is well on board with this agenda. Their what was it? I was reading through their environment policy, and they come out bold faced. You know, we want to implement Agenda 21. That's New World Order legislation, isn't it? Along with Codex Alimentarius, all through the UN. And you look at the wording of these documents, and then you go and read the environment policy of National and Labor,
yeah,
and it's identical. To the Greens.
Yeah. Can I tell you about our environmental policy?
Go for it.
Environmental policy has things in it which say that there's gonna be green data centers set up so it can go to to things like green research, helping our environment, all those sorts of stuff. Yeah.
Well, if you're going to be doing research into environmental studies, more or less government programs on it, I think that's probably a good idea, because what the other ones seem to be doing is not researching into the problems at all or what's causing them or anything. They just say blanketedly, oh, it's carbon change, it's CO2. The environmental problems that we have are far larger than a single non-toxic compound in the atmosphere, methinks. The amount of pesticides, herbicides, and goodness knows what other genocides that are going on all over the place because of chemical contamination or even purposeful chemicals in the water supply like fluoride. These are things the environmental lobbies don't even mention, and they're infinitely more important, in my opinion.
Yeah. That's why, at the moment, we are having a discussion on this, on our website. If you go to internetparty.org.nz, search policy for, and then click on the environmental policy, people can have their say at the door to join us. I would encourage anyone listening to this to join up, because we definitely need your ideas and some new ways of thinking.
Well, I think that's probably one of the interesting elements that I've seen to the rebirth of politics through the internet, is now people have access to their constituents in a very direct format. And I think policy, legislation, and things of that nature can be done via discussion that is very easy to participate in. In so doing, it's more robust, often a lot more inclusive, and it sometimes takes longer, other times doesn't, but it always tends to come up with better, more workable solutions through the processing. Rather than what's called the Delphi technique meetings, where you go into the meeting as the chairman with a set agenda and you basically tell everybody at the end of the day, yes, thank you for all your opinions and whatnot. This is the policy we're going to enact. Thank you for having your frickin' say.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like, there's politics within politics, I think that when we vote, it's not actually really counted as people who have the most money get the most say in how we should run the country.
Well, conveniently, the internet party is fronted by a multimillionaire.
I know that, but, I'm not saying, Kim.com's wrong to do that. I'm just saying, there should be more transparency between the people at the bottom and the people at the top, you know what I mean?
Well, because I think everybody's opinion carries equal weight. Yeah. If none of their opinions are based on facts, and just like everybody's opinion carries the same weight as it is based on facts, and the fact of the matter is, New Zealand is having legislation passed progressively to take away all our freedoms, all our rights, all our land, all our money, everything.
Yeah,
basically taking away step by step everything that it is to be a New Zealander, everything that it is to be human.
Yeah,
I mean, so. Who are you going to call? There ain't no line for Ghostbusters out there, bro.
yeah, exactly. I think the internet party is the best choice, because we will be honest up front with the people, and I won't let my constituents down if I'm elected. Yeah.
Well, I also think about this. The importance of the internet party is as important as the internet itself.
Yeah.
How does pretty much all business and social interaction and media viewing and all of that get done nowadays?
For social media, I mean, it's been happening since 2004 in America, and then it started in 2007 in New Zealand, so it's spread right across the world in a really quick time frame. We have to get used to this new technology and being more upfront and honest with people. Yeah.
Well, indeed, things need to be put in place in order to ensure accountability of representatives, because what really kind of gets my goat about voting once every couple of years is that that's all the participation that's required from you as a voter, is once every couple of years you decide which person that you know nothing about to cast a piece of paper that you don't know who counts for somebody. You know, they're not going. The majority of people aren't going out to protests or sitting in council meetings, taking notes, exposing corruption. It's done by a very, very small minority of participants.
Yeah, I mean, apart from the fact we have by-elections, which don't come up that often, but there definitely needs to be more accountability, I think.
Well, how exactly can you ensure accountability when Parliament's sovereign? That's the other thing. I interviewed, what was his name? Russell Norman from the Leader of the Greens when we were having the Mount Albert by-election back in 2008, I think, when Helen Clark left for the UN, incidentally. I'm just a coincidence theorist, of course. And he said that because Parliament's sovereign, it can undo any law it wants.
Yeah.
Right? And I was like, whoa, hold on a second. That means that having no accountability is part of the power of Parliament.
Yeah. Well, we need to ensure by drafting laws that allow for more accountability for MPs. Spending, for example, in terms of what they're spending with us on a restaurant meal or fries or meeting with dignitaries from other countries, for example.
You're kind of like talking about a version of the United States Logan Act. So if our parliamentarians are inviting foreign dignitaries around to their house and having dinner and talking about under the table stuff, they can't do that. It's illegal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that would sound like a basic thing, right? Activist and public watchdog Penny Bright has come up with a number of parliamentary rules, which I think would be really good as an induction. For example, making it illegal in New Zealand to knowingly misrepresent your policy.
Yeah.
That's not currently illegal.
Like, I'll give you an example. When Julia Gillard, the former Australian Prime Minister, went into the election saying that there were going to be no carbon tax. What did she do after the election? She popped the carbon tax on the Greens. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And this is the exact same thing that happens. Julia Gillard, she goes into coalition with the Greens the day after her election, after her main election platform was no carbon tax, and then signs one. And then, John Key, he says he's going to reduce the national debt. He increased our debt more than all previous prime ministers in this country's history combined in his first term alone.
Yeah.
The exact same thing is true of Barack Obama, who said he's going to take control of the U.S. national debt. He borrowed more than all U.S. presidents combined in his first term alone. See, it's the same kettle of fish. You see the exact same pattern happening. And it's allowed to happen because what they're doing isn't illegal, even though it's clearly fraud.
I mean, they should be putting a tax on mining, for example.
Well, maybe we should have a scumbaggery tax, you know? Like, if you've proven to engaged in some form of scumbaggery, that you should be taxed on your income.
You think so? Well, maybe, I mean, it would depend on the circumstances.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, scumbaggery is quite difficult to expose because it's very good at concealing itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Either that or spinning it as nothing. For example, excuse me, my name's Kim.com, Mr. Key, and you're the only person with authority to allow the GCSB to surveil anybody specific and whatnot, and you got them to surveil me, and it was illegal, along with 80 other people. And then John Key says, he's a conspiracy theorist, therefore it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Far out, man. I can't believe this country. And people swallow it. And then, no, Josh, I've been out protesting John Key with a big sign that says not wanted, you know, like the old Wild West posters that say wanted. This one says not wanted. It's got a picture of John Key on it, you know. And you get people driving past you going, I've got one thing to say about John Key. Thank you, you know. Yep. Thank you for what, bro? Getting us into debt? Taking away the rights, exploiting the country, destroying it, you know, selling it out to foreign banks, allowing the UN to have bigger control of us, signing us up to NATO, giving the US Coast Guard control of our frickin' waters. Are you kidding me, bro? The only people who like him know nothing about him, and that's why they can like him.
Yeah. Well, I was a member of the National Party back in 2010, and this is before it all went downhill, and I felt like I didn't get a say in the policy, you know?
Yeah, and what they tell you the policy is, and what the policy really is, ain't always exactly the same thing, are they?
Yeah.
And let's hope the Internet Party can change that current history of New Zealand politics. Joshua Perry, ladies and gentlemen, is it theinternetparty.org.nz or just internetparty.org.nz?
Internetparty.org.nz.
All right, that's the one. Check it out, ladies and gentlemen. Might be worth a read of the legislation and give them your vote if you want to not be a slave. You know, might be an idea. All right. Thank you, my fellow slaves of the plantation. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We are sponsored by a number of books on the website there, including the Crowdfunding Revolution. And also, I wanted to point you towards some of our sponsors, the Range of Illusion book there, as well as the High Tea Cafe, the Gourmet Soap Kitchen in Wagga Wagga. I like saying the word Wagga Wagga for some reason. I don't know why. And also Blue Shield. So if you don't, you know, there's another thing about surveillance, ladies and gentlemen. It's usually done through wireless technology a lot of the time and whatnot. Blue Shields won't protect you from that surveillance, but they might actually protect you from some of the harmless so-called harmless radio waves that bathe you in total radiation and split apart your cells like they're a frickin' egg inside your bloodstream. Go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and click on that little Blue Shield banner down there. There's a number of devices that'll protect you from that shit. Thank you very much. We'll see you after the break. And I'm on my way to believe it. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Getting straight into it, my very special guest, longtime friend and confidant and fellow scumbaggery exposer, Penelope S. Bright. I believe she's like the granddaughter or something of some kind of old military man named Bright. And she's incidentally got a lot of bright ideas. Penny, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vinny. It's actually Penelope Mary Bright, which I think is rather appropriate because I'm going to be standing against John Key in the Helensville electorate. So if anyone wants to help, the bank account to which they can make donations if they'd like to help is PM Bright. What do you think about that?
Yeah. Bright for PM and donate to PM Bright.
Yes, yes. God, isn't life strange? Anyway, we'll come back to that one. But, goodness me, what exciting times we live in.
There's been a lot going on in New Zealand, especially with scumbaggery and corruption. In fact, there always has been, but it usually doesn't get exposed or the perpetrators don't usually get punished for it. That's how corrupt New Zealand is. But now it's different a little bit, isn't it, Penny?
Well, it is. And I mean, some of us who have been very focused over the last 6 years trying to expose the absolute steaming pile of BS that New Zealand is perceived to be the least corrupt country in the world, when the Corruption Perception Index from Transparency International is actually not very transparent itself. It's made up of subjective opinions of anonymous business people, like Business Roundtable. Do you think New Zealand is corrupt? Nope. Seriously, eh? So, oh no, it's so exciting because what's happening next Thursday at 2:15 p.m. in the Auckland High Court, Justice Wiley will give his verdict on the John Banks trial for alleged electoral fraud.
Whoa. John Banks is the roadrunner and the judge is Wiley Coyote.
Well, the thing is that myself, I actually am of the opinion that not only is John Banks going to be convicted, but he's going to jail. I think it'll be shock and awe because the world is watching. And as someone who's been focused for over 3 years trying to get the former leader of the ACT Party, the party for personal responsibility, held accountable. I mean, I stood against John Banks in 2011 in Epsom, trying to say, well, how come ACT's one law for all hasn't applied to John Banks and Don Brash over Hewlett? And talk about go everywhere on that one, made formal complaints to the Finance Markets Authority, Serious Fraud Office, New Zealand Police, petitioned Parliament for an inquiry into the Hewlett wealth management prosecutions, because Banks and Brash were two out of three directors, and it was only Peter Hewlett who was ever charged. And the charge was that if you sign a registered prospectus which contains misleading information, it's like strict liability offence, drive 60Ks in the 50Ks area, well, that's the end of you. They were never charged. And what happened was the Commerce Select Committee, which was dominated by National Party MPs, had no matters to bring to the House. That's why New Zealand needs to ratify the UN Convention Against Corruption, and we need a genuinely independent Commission Against Corruption.
Do we even need the UN? I mean, why can't we do it ourselves?
It's just that the UN Convention Against Corruption, it's up to sovereign national states to decide to ratify it, and, you know, it's... the UN...
But once ratified, how does a sovereign state get out of it?
No, what happens is, once it's, in order to ratify, sovereign states must get their domestic anti-corruption legislative framework in place. And New Zealand hasn't ratified it because, get a load of this, we're perceived to be the least corrupt country in the world, that our domestic anti-corruption legislative framework is not yet in place. Go figure that one out. And the fact is that, that's another issue, dear old Judith Collins, our Minister of Justice, she promised Transparency International New Zealand last year in writing that her organised crime and anti-corruption legislation bill, which is like an omnibus bill, which is going to tie together a lot of loose ends that needed to be changed before New Zealand could ratify, that it will be presented to the House last year. Well, guess what? We're just now, nearly in June 2014, her bill has yet to make its entrance into the parliamentary sausage machine. And I've checked with parliamentary services. Parliament rises on the 31st of July. That's the end of Parliament. And if a bill is going through lawful due process in a proper way from woe to go in Parliament, then it takes 6 months to go through the proper legislative process. Well, do we have 6 months from June to the 31st of July? Why goodness, we don't. So by a simple majority in the House, a bill, the process can be squished into 1 month, or what they can do is rush it through under urgency in one day. Well, how does that fit in with New Zealand doing things in a proper way when we're addressing this issue of corruption? Judith Collins, in my considered opinion, is not fit for duty. Not only should she be sacked as Minister of Justice, but she should be out of Parliament. I mean, if she hadn't been so busy looking after the private commercial interests of Oravida Limited, of which her very close friends own it and are directors of it, including her husband's a director, give me a break. Unbelievable, eh?
This country's very similar like that. Michael Stiasny, personal friend to John Key, he gets involved in all these big government sell-out clean-up packages and things like that, and they wind up lining their own pockets as well as the pockets of their mates and then getting positions and at the top of corporate banking or something like that, as happened to the previous Justice Minister, Simon Power.
Yes.
You know?
Well, the thing is, Vinny, that fellow public watchdog and friend Grace Hayden, in 2 weeks' time we're over at another major anti-corruption conference in Brisbane. This one, thank God, you didn't have to pay any registration fee, so it's only sort of the cost of getting there and accommodation. But this will be my fourth anti-corruption conference, and I have to say that there are endemic forms of corruption in New Zealand, grand corruption, which happens at the highest levels, which most people in this country have never even heard of, including mainstream media.
Do you believe levels extend beyond the government and indeed go offshore controlling interests like the arm of a octopus?
Well, they're interlinked. There's no doubt about that. But, I mean, I talk about, you know, state capture, which I'd never heard of until I went to the Transparency International Conference in 2010. And state capture is where vested interests get their way at the policy level before the law is passed. And I thought, oh, my God, that's exactly how the Business Roundtable did it. They focused on policy. And then they got the law that they wanted, or the laws that they wanted. And where you go to find out where state capture is occurring, you look for the regulatory impact statements, regulatory impact reports, and you see with whom government policy and analysts, who are they consulting with? And what you tend to find is that very much vested interests are treated as if they're independent third parties. What happens? The law goes through the parliamentary sausage machine, and these vested interests, usually corporate vested interests, get what they want. State capture.
And on top of this, we've had a look at the list of registrants and people who are vouching for Transparency International. And what's so hilarious about it is that all of them are the top business leaders and top political handlers and government departments and things like that, which many of us have suspected for a long time to be corrupt.
Well, the thing is that, Transparency International, full stop. I went to the conference in 2010, and what I did, I blew the whistle to my eyeballs, bled basically, and I distributed hundreds of copies of a New Zealand corruption reality checklist, because I believe that there are objective yardsticks that you can measure against, like, has New Zealand ratified the UN Convention Against Corruption? No. Does New Zealand have an independent commission against corruption? No. Do members of parliament have an enforceable code of conduct? No. Do New Zealand judges have an enforceable code of conduct? No. And I mean, I had about 20 points which are objectively measurable against. And I said, basically, I believe this is what Transparency International should do. They should base their measurement of corruption against things which are objectively measurable. corruption reality checklist. I said, this checklist could be used by any country in the world. And did they listen? They did not. So as far as I'm concerned, and I was in regular contact with Transparency International, and now as far as I'm concerned, the Corruption Perception Index is absolutely toilet paper. It's not worth the paper upon which it is written. Seriously. Because another major thing with Transparency International, do they look at tax havens? They don't. And where do the filthy, undeserving rich put their bribes? They put their bribes into tax havens. So if you're an organisation which is purportedly concerned about bribery and corruption, wouldn't you think you'd look at where they put the bribes? So why aren't they? And I came across
my conspiratorial mind would say because they're taking those bribes.
Well, the fact is, in New Zealand, Transparency International. Let's go through a little track record here, shall we? Do you remember back in 2009? I'm an anti-corruption activist. You know, I can point a stick at things where I've actually helped to get some changes. I'm an anti-corruption activist. Well, guess what? Transparency International New Zealand. Are absolutely opposed to having genuine anti-corruption activists as part of their organisation, because what's happening is they're part of the myth and the fraud that New Zealand's the least corrupt country in the world. And if you actually go on their website and check their sponsors, what they've got, about 95% of their funding they get from government departments who have an absolutely vested interest in maintaining that myth. Their number one platinum sponsor is the Office of the Auditor General. Well, guess what? You'll love this. Okay, what happened was I had a lot of girly swat over Christmas and read heaps of stuff. And what I discovered was, oh my God, our Auditor General, was she still a shareholder in Sky City? Because I read, you know, this is when you get a ruler and a pencil and we underline stuff. So this is studying, reading, not just flip. Like
I couldn't have made this up if I was the most cynical. Oh my God.
Well, you remember when the Greens made a fuss about the Sky City deal, because first of all you had the deal, then you had the legislation to entrench the deal. Well, the deal was subject to an Auditor General investigation. But when you read the tiny, tiny, tiny fine print, guess what? Auditor General Lynn Provost, she didn't carry out that inquiry because she was a shareholder in Sky City. So it was the Deputy Auditor General that carried out this report, and I thought, oh my God, I wonder if the Auditor General is still a shareholder. And the reason why I asked that question to myself was because I last year had asked the Auditor General, Lynn Provost, to conduct an inquiry as to why Organised and Financial Crime Agency of New Zealand, OFCANS, who specialise in money laundering, why they had done no due diligence on the increased risk of money laundering arising from the Sky City deal. She declined to investigate. She danced around on the head of a pin and said it was a policy issue, which it was not, because OFCANS come under Vote Police. They get money under the police budget. Their job, their stated job, is to help stop money laundering. They hadn't done their job. Inquiry. Guess what? At the time, the Auditor General declined to investigate OFCANS. She was still a shareholder in Sky City. As far as I know, she still is. Well, so what I did, I managed to get a petition into Parliament, and thank you, Dennis O'Rourke from New Zealand First, and this petition was sponsored by New Zealand First, asking for an inquiry as to why the Auditor General had failed to conduct an inquiry into OFCANS for lack of due diligence on the increased risk of money laundering. Well, it went to Finance and Expenditure Select Committee, which of course has a majority of National Party MPs, and guess what their reply was? We have no matters to bring before the House. How the hell is that not corruption? How the hell is that not Parliament?
Well, people in this country aren't
endorsing and supporting corruption.
People in this country aren't suspicious, Penny. I mean,
They're changing. I think they are changing, Vinny. I think that this year, at the beginning of this year, I predicted, okay, I've now turned into some sort of soothsayer, but I predicted that this would be the year of huge scandals relating to corruption, like a giant corrupt corporate onion, layer upon layer upon layer. Well, goodness me, there's layers I didn't even know of that are now peeling, and the public are guessing it. And I mean, don't forget last year when I campaigned against corrupt corporate control of the Auckland region, I polled fourth and got nearly 12,000 votes. So people are guessing it.
And whether or not it's enough, we don't know as yet. Time will tell. And the thing is, these people move very quickly, like cockroaches scuttling into the underwood. I wouldn't be surprised if there might be, I don't know, some surprise changes in the political lineups or something like that. Like, oh, they're retiring. They're going overseas to some kind of thing where they're outside of our jurisdiction, perhaps.
Well, the thing is this, that's why I want to stand against John Key in Helensville, because I want to keep the blowtorch on the issue of corruption. I do. And I mean, you've been involved.
Do you believe John Key himself has been involved in corruption, and specifically what cases of corruption do you think he might be involved with?
Well, don't forget, I mean, you were the one that did the filming, and that YouTube clip is still up there, as you recall. I mean, I made a formal complaint to both the police and Serious 4 office back in 2008 before the election against John Key over Transrail. And when the police and Serious 4 failed to do anything on the advice of a senior QC, I took a private prosecution against John Key over Transrail. And what happened was, this is in the same 2008 election where there was this massive campaign to try and stop New Zealand First and Winston Peters becoming part of any coalition government. And if you sling enough mud at the wall, some of it sticks. And I mean, you and I know, because I turned over the pages of 3 months' worth of Heralds and you filmed them. And we have that as a record showing, because what we found, there was not one sentence about my complaint against John Key over Transrail in the Herald, not one sentence. And at the same time, when Rodney Hyde was getting Man on the Moon headlines, when he made a complaint to the Serious Ford office against New Zealand First, Man on the Moon, front page. Well, wouldn't you think there might be one or two people a little bit interested over the John Key Transrail issue? Not absolutely censored, not one sentence. And the result of that slinging mud at the wall against New Zealand First and Winston Peters was that they did not make the 5% threshold. They got about 4.2% of the votes. And of course, it's because big business, majority of CEOs, did not want Winston Peters or New Zealand First to be part of any coalition government. You know, that's it. Follow the money. Those who have the gold make the rules. And that's what happened. So fascinating stuff. But that's why I think it's going to be such fun in Helensville, because first there was that, and then you remember because you made the YouTube clip. Now, dear friend John Duncan, now deceased, he filmed that Grey Power meeting when I asked John Key to his face if he was personally profiting from New Zealand's growing indebtedness owing to the fact that he is still a shareholder in the Bank of America. And that's, quite a few people have viewed that, but the look on his face when he knew that question was coming, eh? Anyway, and then of course, the last time I've had a go at John Key, and this is the first time ever as part of the parliamentary process when I had a go at him as a submitter against the GCSB. And and I asked him to his, I said to his face, and it was published in the Herald the next day, Prime Minister, you may be used to doing, this is in relation to the Sky City deal, you may be used to doing deals over dinner and over the phone as part of your custom and practice arising from being an ex-foreign exchange advisor to the New York Federal Reserve or the head of derivatives for Merrill Lynch, but it's no way to run a country. That got reported, and then later on, about 10 minutes, and I said, Prime Minister, this is probably an offer you haven't had so far today. You show me yours and I'll show you mine. Everyone's thinking, what? And I said, bank accounts. Open up your bank accounts, your tax havens, your trust accounts, your Swiss bank accounts, And nothing to hide, nothing to fear. You show me yours and I'll show you mine. And mine will take about 30 seconds because I'm nearly up to my $500 overdraft in the ANZ. And I've got about $2 in my Kiwi Bank account. And that's it. Come on, Prime Minister. Nothing to hide. Nothing to fear. Anyway.
I always thought that if the Prime Minister is going to be posting up, you know, the GCSB bill and taking away everybody's right to privacy and whatnot. Well, I'd say he should probably lead by example, you know, have some CCTV cameras installed in his bedroom so that anybody in the country can log on to the internet and plug into the video feed and watch you when you sleep, Prime Minister.
Well, I'm not so concerned about the bedroom, but I am concerned about the bank account. And I, quite frankly, my view is that anyone in public office, their bank accounts should be made available for scrutiny. I'm not saying for every member of the public, but there should be like some commissioner for integrity or whatever who's got the right to see where, you know.
What kind of commission of integrity would we have in this country, Penny?
If
the only commission in this country that I see of an official capacity involves the commission of a crime.
you have a point, but I mean, what I'd like people to remember is back in the late 1980s, how New South Wales got their independent commission against corruption bills because the massive scandals over police corruption. I mean, where the people lead, the politicians will follow. So it's all about fuss. It's all about keeping the heat on. Like I say, and that's why I want to have a go directly and campaign against John Key in Helensville to keep that blowtorch on corruption. Because, it's a lot easier to campaign an electorate of about 50,000 people as it was in the Auckland region, which is 1.4 million. You know, so I'm really looking forward to it. But, another couple of things I'd like to raise is that, yes, in terms of, you know, the news of the day, which is the this coalition between the Mana Party and the Internet Party, and the choice of Laila Hari as the leader of the Internet Party, please do not ask me to have a frontal lobotomy. And why I say this is that a lot of people do not remember, or it's been glossed over in the media, about how the Laila's from the so-called left. Is that right? Well, I'm sorry. She dropped those credentials for me when she was appointed to be on the ATA, the Auckland Transition Agency, or my preferred definition, the Association of Treacherous Aucklanders, which helped to set up the super city. Laila Hari was appointed. She had a human resources type role there. God knows how much they paid her. It must have been a fortune, because what a coup, you know. And I mean, that the super city has been a corporate coup. It's been a corporate takeover. So anyone that helped to facilitate that and then purports to be left wing, I'm sorry, that's just bollocks. Absolute bollocks. And at the time, in my customary fashion, I approached Laila Hari directly about that, and I said to her face, I said, is it true that you've joined the ATA? And she says, Penny, I don't share your same jaundiced view about the super city. I said, it's a corrupt corporate takeover. Turned my back on her and walked away, and that's the facts.
For the confused here, meaning me, jaundiced, what does that mean exactly?
Jaundiced, well, I think that, yeah, my anti-super city view, she didn't share it. In fact, none of the political parties were actually opposed to the super city. Let's get it right. I mean, facts are facts.
Yeah, can I make a point here as well, Penny, just based on that? Every single party has Agenda 21 as their environmental policy. Every single party supports the corrupt corporate coup and the centralisation process and everything that gets folded us into the New World Order global takeover ruled by bankers. Okay, so what choice have we got?
Well, the thing is, that's where the people lead, the politicians will follow, where there's a really clear demand and a lot of fuss and a lot of bother, because I can tell you, if you don't wear the corporate suits and operate at 30,000 feet, the only way ordinary people get change is by making a hell of a fuss. you've got to organise outside Parliament to get change inside Parliament. And, I mean, I've been an activist for over, well over 40 years now, and that's the reality. So, but, I mean, like I say, you know, people got it in the mayoral campaign, nearly 12,000 votes. And what's fascinating is in the Helensville electorate, don't forget, it comes within the super city boundaries. So I know there's a lot of people up that way that hate the super city. You know, all this economies of scale and it's going to be good for citizens and ratepayers. Hello. It was all about bigger contracts for fewer but bigger private contractors. And but the other huge thing about the Internet Party, which really deeply concerns me, is they support public-private partnerships. Now, hello, the super city has helped create the economies of scale scope because it's bigger now, bigger contracts for fewer but bigger private contractors. What, first council-controlled organisations, then public-private partnerships? Lala Hari helped with that. Lala Hari, when she was in the Alliance, was opposed. Their policy was opposed to public-private partnerships. They did see it as a form of privatisation. Well, what's the position now, Lila? And what's the position? And what's the position of the Mana Party? You know, I've asked that, and I need to make more of a fuss about that because people need to remember history and be careful what you ask for. I mean, I know we do need to get rid of this National Act government. We do, but by the same time, I think that people have to have their eyes wide open and not, you know, just exclude the facts. Yeah, you do, because back in 1984, I've been around a while, when people were so anti-Muldoon, and understandably, but, you know, everyone rallied round to help get rid of Muldoon, and don't forget the role of Bob Jones, who helped set up the New Zealand Party, which split the vote, which allowed Labor to get in, then we got Loginomics. So just be aware. Is what I'm trying to say. So
don't be a sheep. There's 40 million of them, okay, already. You don't need another 4 million.
Well, seek truth from facts. And I mean, I'm sorry, but, I mean, my bullshit barometer's just way on high at the moment because, my job is to be a public watchdog, and I will tell the truth, whether people like it or not. But I mean that, and I mean I am quite even-handed. I mean, you know, I've put a lot of work in trying to get Banks to trial, and that wasn't supposed to happen, was it? And when Lisa Prager, myself, and Trevor Mallard, we were the original complainants that got this police investigation into John Banks over alleged electoral fraud, and then when they played that two-hour interview with Banks. Banks' interview with the police in court, and Banks was so distracted about the bullshit he'd said to the cops that he forgot that he was in a public goldfish bowl, and not only were people listening to this audio, they were actually watching him, and then he indulged in his own personal, somewhat revolting form of personal recycling, shall we say, which has now gone international.
Well,
but anyway,
can we define that, and then we've got to go to break, Penny, I'm sorry. Okay. What's John Banks recycling himself exactly?
You know, when he picked his ear.
Well, was he picking his ear and eating it, was he? Was he saving it for later?
I mean, I just think it's a degree of the distraction that he was under. He was just so listening to what he said, which is obviously best evidence because it came directly from John Banks, who didn't take the stand himself. Nothing to hide, nothing to fear, John. Then why didn't you put yourself in the witness box? Oh, guess what? Because you dug such a great big bloody hole that, you know, anything you were going to say is you're going to be open to cross-examination. I mean, he basically, Banks put himself in the blender.
Yeah. Well, you know what? What was it? What's red and green and goes 700 miles an hour?
A frog in the blender.
I don't know this one. Yeah, anyway, but fascinating. But, yeah, we'll have a result on next Thursday, 2:15, Auckland High Court, Waterloo Quadrant. Come along, folks. It's going to be historic and unprecedented.
Penny Bright, ladies and gentlemen, Public Watchdog and Good Citizenship Award recipient and soon to be on the first New Zealand blacklist and drone strike.
All right, that's another... Yeah, okay, we can come back to that.
We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Okay. Don't you go anywhere.
smile surrounded by a border. Envy, hate, and anger ready to evade disorder. We've seen the likes of them coming through. Now what about the children? The suffering that torments us time after time.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of The Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's a little Kiwi collaborator broadcast today. My special guest is sound engineer and former activist, Simon Shea Desbois. Simon, welcome to the program.
Oh, well, thank you.
Okay. Now, we've met up a number of times at parties and drinking and so on and so forth, and almost every single time the exact same topic comes up and it doesn't get resolved, and that is the situation that you've had dealing with SIFs and the family court and all the nonsense that's going on there. And what occurs to me is that basically you need a bit of a chance to really kind of lay it out for people, because you've given up on the system, basically trying to help you out, get your daughter back and what have you, and just basically think it's all BS. So I want to offer you the platform today to just sort of tell your story, and I can be assured, and I know for a fact, that there's many, many, many other fathers out there in New Zealand and indeed around the world with similar struggles that I think yours will replicate. So if you wouldn't mind, Simon, just tell us a little bit about who you are, what it is you do, and then we'll get into it.
Okay. Well, it's a tough thing to categorize. Sorry, Vinny, just give me a second. Stage fright. Okay, so where do I start? My daughter Anika about 6 years ago, she was born. I've always been actively involved in her life on every level, you know. Me and the mum never saw eye to eye on most things, and it was a very complicated meeting how we met. The whole thing to begin with was just one big debacle. But, had been actively involved. I wasn't, you know, for the first 6-12 months, wasn't really... You know, I wasn't her primary caregiver or anything like that, but, you know, I was seeing her 2-3 days a week. She was staying over, you know, most of those nights. And the mum just kind of decided one day that she would just move off to Hawke's Bay and just uplift her and randomly drag off with this guy who was not a particularly desirable character. Had a lot of run-ins with drugs and all that like that. And yeah, just basically for months, I just heard nothing. And so that's how the whole proceedings begun. It was just me basically saying, look, you just can't run off. And, you know, I'm in Auckland. You're meant to be in Auckland. You can't just take her. So at that point, she tried to tell me that she wasn't even my child, which was hilarious in itself, and said that I wasn't on the birth certificate. So I had to go through all the legal means of getting a proper copy of the birth certificate and then filing for my initial affidavit. Now, the initial affidavit was quite effective. We within a few weeks, the situation was resolved. Courts outlined that she must stay in Auckland and blah, blah, blah. And that's where it all began. So that was about 4.5 years ago to this day. Since then, I'd say a total of 100 or so affidavits have been filed to and from each parties. We've had many interim arrangements and things have... you know, gone one way or the other. And so, you know, I have been, in most cases, primary custodian of Anika in a lot of cases. But, you know, it's 4.5 years later. The situation is still not resolved. And it's crazy because the situation couldn't be any more black and white from a viewpoint of where both parents stand on the issues of, like, just... up, you know, being able to, you know, raise a child, stability, education, safety, all these things that, you know, you'd think in a logical system would just stand out strong, do not, because it seems even after 4.5 years, $55,000 in legal bills, not a single piece of evidence I've submitted in an affidavit form has been tested to this day, because the court... Essentially, what it does is you file affidavits, and it really becomes a he says, she says situation, because at no point does the court actually test the evidence, because by the time the court gets around to giving you a situation to test the evidence is considered historical because of basically the slow nature of the court. So it's kind of like a rotating door. You file affidavits and you've got all the evidence there. By the time you get to the court, it just becomes very much just a character assassination, or, you know, more gotcha tactics than actually any testing of the evidence. And so I've presented, you know, I've tried to go with transparency. So I've presented all text conversations, all conversations, you know, all records that one's able to get, let it be medical, all the rest. But as stated, it's never been allowed to be tested, and basically they just say come back in 9 months and file again. So it's been a long, long journey. To give you an idea of when I'm referring to stability and why I can't understand why it's just not taken from a more logical point of view, is in Anika's lifetime, I had lived in one abode, one place with her. I'd been there for 7-8 years. The mum, on the other hand, had moved, since, you know, Anika was born to this present day, she's moved 21 times. I've had no run-ins, no criminal record or no run-ins with the law, apart from, like, you know, years and years ago when I was a teenager and I was a political activist, and I never got a criminal record for it. She's had multitude of run-ins with the law, as has many of her partners that she's chosen to be with at any given time. She's had numerous SIFS call-outs, as I've had none that have actually, you know, I've had her call SIFS on me and do things like that, but none of them have actually, once tested, they never showed any validity. Just too many things to think of. So last year, back in January, this was meant to be our big hearing day. We'd been waiting 3.5 years for this. And basically, a day or two before the hearing, my house was arsoned, the one I'd had for 7 years. And the judge saw it on TV. And even before the proceedings, you know, this 5-day hearing that we'd been just waiting for forever and ever to happen, before we even got in there, he had basically made up his mind from what he'd seen of me on television, taking, you know, this is a guy who's just jumped through a burning building off his roof, you know. And it basically, you know, the 5-day hearing got cut down to a 1-day hearing where, you know, I was put on the stand because I was the one who filed the affidavit, so therefore I'm the first to go. You know, I'm still in a state of shock. I'm just, you know, in no good place to, you know, be in the situation. And they basically just threw it out there and then and gave her once again primary custodian rights and basically put me down to a weekend dad role. But the reality since then has been not at all there. I mean, I've been looking after her the majority of the time. But what happened between then and now, you know, the mum got the school. And since then, you know, this is just an example of credibility. So she gets her in school and her attendance is just appalling. The school doesn't notify me of this because they don't recognize me as a custodian parent. And so for whole 3 terms, and Anika's schooling was, you know, she missed 1 in 3 days. And the mum then moved a number of more times. And on top of that, during all this, she's dealing with this partner who has a record of violence, who I don't even want to say what level of violence, because it's quite appalling when you look. He's not meant to be around young children, basically. it's insane. Like, you know, I come from a educated background. Both my parents have their doctorates. You know, we have a sense of morality and this belief that the system is going to do what's best for the child. But we have just seen, you know, my mum's been very supportive throughout this whole process. We've just seen situations where it couldn't be any more black and white in regards to, you know, the parent's position and what would be best for the child. But I can't catch a break with it, no matter how much she screws up. You know, if it's you know, no matter how much she moves, no matter who she lives with, you know, these the amount of violent incidences that seem to happen at her place, and you know, I mean, just to categorize it, you know, this you know, she managed to get $50,000 worth of debts because of a parked car. So, you know, if you want to bring financial into it as well, it's just, you know, but she refuses to, even when I, like this year in particular, you know, she fell to pieces last year, and I ended up enrolling Anika into Freeman's Bay this year because she basically just couldn't do it, ended up having her the majority of the time. But she refuses to recognize or give me the recognition for, you know, for just, you know, basically, you know, having her. Like, I hate to use the word welfare mum, but it's basically what she's got going on. She just doesn't want to, you know, I don't know. Please butt in here, because I could just go on and on. It's, yeah.
I think that was kind of the point. Because I've been studying and looking into this and interviewed a number of people in the same position. They all say the exact same thing. None of the evidence that I have would be good. Doesn't matter how bad the mum is. The mum always gets the child. And that's the way the system's set up. They don't tell you that going in. By the way, it doesn't matter what evidence you put in. The mum's still the mum, and she rules. Okay, so, you know, what that does is a lot of real smart fathers cotton onto that really quickly on, and they get really upset about it and really depressed about it, and then they stop trying to get their kids back because they know that it's basically not possible.
Mm. Well, I mean, in my case, I cottoned on pretty quickly that was the case, but I just thought, you know, the mountains of evidence I would gather would just eventually have to, you know, work in my favor. I mean, like, just, you know, I more than anyone understands that the system has some really corrosive, archaic issues with it, you know? I'm well educated in that reality, but when you're dealing with your own flesh and blood, you just have to hope like hell that something is going to budge. You know, it's bad enough when the court, you know, you think, okay, well, the courts are archaic, but, you know, serfs, that's a body that, you know, should know better. I mean, you'd just think after seven different incidences of the public, you know, not myself, the public referring to this, you know, I don't want to sound derogative, I'm referring to the mum and any partner she's had at the time, you'd think that would clarify the matter. I mean, the best thing I really realized now that I could have done is just have let her collapse a long time ago, because it's like this, you know, I've been picking up the pieces when she isn't able to do it, but at the same time, she's chopping my legs beneath me. So, you know, I'm raising Anika, I'm looking after her the majority of the time, but at the same time, she's cutting me loose, not allowing me to have any kind of say or even any, you know, in times when it was well justified, you know, subsidies or whatever, because half of this process I was studying, you know, throughout this whole entire thing, you know, I'm studying full-time trying to improve my own education, while basically looking after my daughter full time, while the mum just sits there on her lovely $600 a week, you know, just it's you know, from a I refuse to acknowledge that, you know, that justice can be that fucking bullshit, man, to be honest. Like, it's just on so many levels. And The just the things I've heard when I've gone into trial, and these amazing biases that are just bred in. Like, the snapping point for me was only a few weeks ago, and that's why I came to you and told you of this, is that, like, I was so confident this was a you know, guaranteed to go in Anika's and my favor, is because I just had this, you know, phenomenal body of evidence showing poor attendance, where when she had been in my care this year, you know, for the first term of this year, attendance had been spotless, like no mistakes whatsoever, no sick days, no nothing. But in, you know, last year, it was, as I said, it was appalling. It was close to 30-something%. And I just, you know, I walked in there with this, and I walked in with evidence of the homework book, which is another thing we had. So, you know, I do homework with Anika every night, and, you know, we sign the book, and it goes to the teacher the next day. You know, I walked in, you know, with the settlement meeting, presented this to the judge, and the judge just, you know, the mum just started ranting about how she does homework with her, and the judge just goes, oh, don't worry about it, dear. you know, no, I don't sign the book of my kid either. It's just this, you know, and then when I'd present, you know, she was trying to say that the reason she missed so much school last year at her school was because of bullying. And so I presented emails from all the teachers and the school saying there was no bullying of any sorts whatsoever. And the judge, once again, is just like, oh, you know what? Schools don't really like talking about that. So they probably just, you know, they're probably just choosing it. So no matter, it's not about factual evidence. I could present emails. I can present, you know, day-to-day activity. I mean, you know, Chloe says that she doesn't even have me on these days. Anika on these days. But at the same time, you know, I've long since had CCTV out our main foyer. So I say to the judge, look, if you want, I can literally show you the last 6 months of footage of, you know, people entering and leaving my house. And, you know, once again, it's just irrelevant. I mean, even with everything being there, like, you can't, you know, you know, basically when I say that, they just go, oh, you're just paranoid, Ben. So, you know, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. If you gather the evidence, they just blatantly reject it. And so now what's happening is they're saying, look, we'll have another trial in September, October. But by the time it gets to September, October, all the evidence I've presented that I've been just wanting to be tested will now be considered as historical evidence. It will be not even looked at. So my original proceedings when I filed again back in May of this year, by the time it gets to September, they're just going to say, well, how's it been for the last few months? And obviously, you know, at that point, Chloe will just clean up her act and, you know, get her family to, you know, pull it together. And it'll just, you know, she'll then get promoted in custodianship again. And what will happen is she'll just fall back.
She doesn't have any requirements on her or anything. I mean, she could basically, as far as what you're telling me, she could walk into the courtroom with a heroin needle out of her arm and just go, am I a good mother yet? And they'll say, yep, no problem. Take the kid home.
Yeah, as long as you clean up in the next few months, you're fine. That's basically what they say. And they don't base it on any, you know, I mean, I think history is the best indication of what's going to happen in the future. I mean, this is, you know, a scientific way of looking at things is that we determine, you know, it's just statistical analysis, man. I mean, I think they should just get Watson, you know, that Jeopardy supercomputer to just go through this shit and work it out. They should do it with an analytical point of view. I mean, this is, you know, obviously my background being in, you know, game development and all the rest of it and all things media and all things technology, you know, this is the way I look at the world. I don't see how that's a bad thing. I mean, you know, what these trials, they end up being is basically character assassinations. Like, you know, they don't, yeah. I mean, it's not due to lack of funding, because I'll tell you this, the lawyers are getting a f***ing load of money out of this. But the rest of it just seems to be, I don't know if it's a lack of funding or what, but the funding is disproportional. You know, the lawyers are getting a hell of a lot more while the family court itself is getting very little and even getting chopped back even more now under the national government, which makes things even worse because now they're trying to abolish lawyer for child and all this other stuff. And it's just crazy. Like, the system's broken and now they're breaking it even more, basically.
Well, here's the thing. The system's broken for people who are honest, who would expect to, you know, that it'd actually be some kind of court. The problem is it's not a kind of court at all. And right. I don't think people get that. I mean, how is the family court different to regular court? Number one, media aren't allowed to report on anything that happens inside the family court.
Exactly. Family court is, if it was treated like a criminal court, it would be way, way better. This is the thing. It's not. This idea of evidence is absurd. It's just not the case. Like, I always, you know, because some of the evidence I had, I wasn't even allowed to submit. Like, crazy evidence. You know, I'm a bit uncomfortable talking about what I do have, or, you know, for sheer retribution, if you know what I'm saying. And that does worry me a little. So some of it I've kept very close to my belt. But just rest assured, some of the stuff I've got her saying, and, you know, with parties that she's with, should have been hands down considered, because it was, anyone would just go, how could you do that, or how could you put her in that environment?
Well, you may as well, you know, may as well tell us, mate, because the court's not going to listen to it anyway.
Yeah, no, I'm not worried about the court listening to it, if you know what I'm saying. Just rest assured, she was putting in Aniko in positions where I think anyone would just say, yeah, that's absurd. And you're fighting for custody, yet you're putting her in that environment. And let's just say, you know, let's just say drug dealers and the rest of it and pills and just utter debauchery. And, you know, man, I mean, look, I was young once. I had a lot of fun. But I'll tell you what, man, when I was there, you know, for the birth, you know, when I was there, you know, when I became a dad, you know, I just focused purely on strengthening my lifestyle and my ability to raise my daughter. You know, my life was a lot of partying and a lot of fun in my, you know, early 20s. That was, you know, I was 24, man. I'm 32 now. And, you know, I've approved above and beyond, but she just hasn't. And she, you know, during the whole entire process, you know, she continued, you know, there were stages when she continued to work as a prostitute and all these other things. I mean, look, I've got nothing against prostitution, but I do have something against prostitution when you're fighting for custody of your daughter and you're choosing to work as a prostitute but not choosing to actually see her at all during this time. Like, it was crazy. Like, she was...
Like, what's she going to do, have a take your kid to work day?
Well, yeah, no, I mean, like, literally, she was dragging me through the custody battle while refusing to see her daughter because she was too busy getting f***ed up, sleeping till 4 in the afternoon, working all night, and going on massive, you know, booze binges. And yet, you know, me and my friends would have to try, you know, spend weeks just trying to find her to say, look, are you going to have Aniko or not? And once again, I had all this on tape. I had all the phone conversations. I had all this. And I said, look, you know, can I please present this? I had every single one of her ex-flatmates offer to write me an affidavit, you know, to describe what they saw when she was raising her, when she was raising Aniko, when she had Aniko with her. And the system just said, nope, it's too much evidence. We just can't go through all that. So... there's been multitude of opportunities where I've had just nothing but the most condemning evidence, you know, literally, you know, public opinion amongst our peers, you know, everything, character, you know, witness, whatever you call them, people, you know, praising.
Character references.
Character references, thank you, yeah. And it was just, you know, they just refused to see it because basically what that means is it's an open and closed case and they don't want an open and closed case. They want something that drags out for as long as possible, you know.
If I might say so.
Yeah.
Here's the agenda. They go, okay, it's going to cost this guy a hell of a lot of money for lawyers and stuff to come in. We got this lawyer over here that's prosecuting and the judge and everything. They're all getting paid at the same time.
Yeah.
And here's this guy presenting evidence that would stop this gravy train to a halt. He could actually prove one side or the other. Yeah, so how do we continue making our gravy train while there's all this evidence? I know! Ignore it!
Pretty much, man. That's it in a nutshell. Like,
you can't make this stuff up, ladies and gentlemen.
No, you can't. Sorry, am I getting too ranty?
It is the Vinny Eastwood show. I mean, if you were ranty, this is the place to do it. You know?
I know, man. So, you know, I mean, I won't even... I don't know what to do now. I mean, like, I could wait till September and they're just going to tell me exactly the same thing. And then I'm just going to have to reapply again. And I, you know, it's 4.5 years, man. This is actually killing me. Like, you know, forget, you know, just trying to have a normal life and financial and everything else because you can't, it holds your life on so many levels because literally, I can't go to, you know, for employment's sake, for example, I can't go to a boss and say, look, I can work from this time to this time if I can't. Because literally, at the drop of a hat, she might just drop her off for an indefinite period of time. And, you know, there you go. You've got to kind of reshuffle your life. I mean, it's constantly the not knowing of how you're meant to function, you know, by day to day is the biggest stress aspect of it, you know?
It sounds very similar to how Dr. Green described me, what happened to him when he's got all these court appearances and things like that holding over his head. Mm. And what happens to other people who have that kind of thing is that, again, your life gets put on hold and basically it turns you into a free-range prisoner.
Yeah, well, that's how it feels, man, because I'm stuck in Auckland. I can't commit to anything because I never know what's going to happen. I mean, I imagine her life's a lot more relaxed because she generally knows she can pretty much do whatever, and it's very unlikely it's going to fall bad on her, no matter what. And so the difference between me and her is that one of us actually have ambition, and one of us actually, you know, really, you know, I mean, the number of things, you know, I remember just affidavit after affidavit where she's stating that she's getting this job, or she's doing the study, or any of these things. You know, if any of this was just to be tested, if it was just literally not a drop has been tested, you know, any of these bold statements she's made about improving her life or her child, they all fall flat. I mean, dude, you know, a year ago she assured us she wasn't going to be living with this guy because he'd been convicted of sex offending, you know? Like, now she's living with him. Like, this is the insanity of it. I mean, like, you'd think that in itself, you know, would be a closing, you know, aspect of the case, right? Like, the fact that she's living with a convicted sex offender. But no. You'd think the fact that he's now got current charges on him for an act of violence pending. You know, they won't declare what the charges are. They just refer to it as common assault, whatever the f*** that means. You know, can you imagine what that does to a father? You know, just, she's, you know, her choice of guys is not great. And I mean, that, you know, in some respect, that goes for me too. I wasn't the best guy when I met her. But, you know, unlike a lot of these other guys she seems to be, you know, palling around with now, that, you know, the difference is that one of us has moved up and on, you know, like... It's
and one's still stuck, and of course the court system isn't designed to keep you unstuck. Simon, I again apologize that this has happened to you. It wasn't my fault, but yeah, man, it happens. Yeah, it happens to many fathers. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on the vinnieeastwoodshow.com, and check out our sponsors there. The High Tea Cafe in New Lynn, and also some of the book sponsors that we have on the website as well. The Crowdfunding Revolution by Kevin Lawton, and The Range of Illusion by B. Holmes. We'll be right back. Gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest today from Christchurch is Colin Stokes. Colin, welcome to the program.
Yeah, g'day, Vincent.
Could you tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do down there in Christchurch, mate?
Pretty much just a Kiwi bloke. I'm an architectural designer. I've been currently tied up in a bit of a corrupt battle with the council for the last 4 years, and that's been taking most of my time up, so I haven't been getting much design work done in recent times.
Doesn't sound like you've been getting much sleep over it either.
No, sleep is very short as well, yes.
Well, tell us a little bit about the corruption. I mean, are you bound under sub judice BS or any stuff like that that will prevent you from telling the truth to the people?
No, fortunately, I can prove all the proof, so I can say whatever I like, because you can only get done if you are telling lies, which I don't.
Well, then, by all means, regale me.
Okay. Well, I'm a small share owner of a little bit of land here, which is part of a new residential subdivision. what's happened here is that the developer that was in control of the whole of the subdivision, including our own, he did some backroom deals with the council, Christchurch City Council, and he radically departed from the rules required in the city plan, the planning rules, and also departed from the safety standards required for roading.
Who did he know in the council to give him the sign-offs?
Quite a few. There's a lot of people involved in there.
We'd be talking about a vertical integration of management, like there'd be a person on top of that person and that person. They've all got the same connections to this one guy?
Well, we went right to the top in the finish because we worked through the people that were making these decisions behind closed doors with the developer. We went right up to the top to the mayor. We went to Tony Merritt, who was the previous chief executive for the Christchurch City Council, who's left with his tail between his legs. We went to Bob Parker, now Sir Bob Parker at the time as well. Told him that his staff were stealing the safety amenities off the community, such as cycle lanes, required turning medians on the roads, that type of thing. The whole of the roads were just bottlenecked down from the adjoining roads in the adjoining subdivisions. And effectively, they consented roads that were deemed to be seriously and significantly unsafe by a independent safety audit that was eventually requested by the council after about 4 years of trying to bring this to their attention.
Under the Agenda 21 public-private partnership protocols, if you build devices and things of that nature for a city council under contract, you are immune from criminal prosecution for any substandard work.
Well, what happens in these situations, the developer is always responsible for constructing the roads and then they're vested to the council afterwards. What the developer needs to do is first get a resource consent for the roads, which requires them to be obviously designed to standards. And if they depart from those standards, they then need to get a resource consent to depart from the standards. The Resource Management Act requires that adversely affected parties need to be notified. So, of course, everybody that use roads are adversely affected if the roads being constructed are going to be below standards and deemed to be seriously and significantly unsafe.
And that's, of course, if they have qualifications in that particular area and know what safe from unsafe and don't just kind of go along to get along.
Well, the developer's surveyor actually wrote to the council advising the council that these narrow roads that they were building complied with New Zealand Standards 4404. However, that was wrong. They didn't. The council officer unfortunately believed what he was reading, and he allowed the roads to be constructed without a consent, illegally. So,
Wait a second. This was a power granted to the Christchurch City Council after the earthquake, I think it was. The Earthquake Recovery Minister, Jerry Brownlee, rushed this through Parliament under urgency, which means you can do, the council can pretty much do anything without a permit.
Well, no, this actually goes back to 2009 and 2010 before the earthquakes even happened. So this was all underway. These roads were being built illegally before the earthquakes struck. So
well, in that case, what that legislation did is it made it retroactively legal, didn't it?
Well, what the council staff did, they got around the Resource Management Act by forming a process that's unorthodox. Effectively, what they did, they denied that anybody was adversely affected by unsafe roads, including the residents like myself that would be forced to use these roads, the access to our current properties to be cut off, and we have to travel through these roads that were being built illegally and that are unsafe. So we're adversely affected by these roads. So we told the council right from the outset when we saw these roads being built to the non-complying standards, we said, what's going on here? These don't comply. We have to use these roads. We're adversely affected. You need to notify us so we can make submissions. They oppressed us. They denied us a legal say. They allowed the roads to be continued to be built illegally. And then they set about a process to retrospectively consent what was already built. Now, what they did to do to get that through, council staff effectively became co-applicants with the developer and they set about getting evidence to support the decisions they had already made behind closed doors. So they went out and solicited traffic engineers, etc., to all agree to them. And of course, if the traffic engineers didn't agree, they'd just go to a different traffic engineer.
That sounds like the Delphi technique. That's what they use in big public meetings and stuff. The chairman in meetings have a meeting beforehand and decide what the outcome is. And then anybody who says anything different during the public version of the meeting, they just don't count it in the end and say, thank you, everybody's had their submissions, this is what we're doing, which is what they were planning to do anyway.
It's exactly what they did. They set up a kangaroo court. They engaged, because they were going to consent these roads internally in the council until we kicked up a fuss. As I said, we went to the CEO of the council, went to the mayor, the councillors, we went to our local MP, Amy Adams. We put basically pressure on the council because we could see that these roads wouldn't be safe. So what they did, they decided, right, I will get a commissioner to make this decision for us, and therefore that'll be independent. So they set up a meeting between the commissioner and they allowed residents to go along, but we had no legal standing whatsoever. We weren't allowed to give evidence. We weren't allowed to make legal submissions. We were allowed to talk to the commissioner when he let us. The commissioner, David Kirkpatrick, he mocked us when we pointed out dangerous aspects of the subdivision that hadn't been addressed. He basically asked us if we were going to get the community police there to sort it out, and just flogged us off. So in the finish, we had no say whatsoever, but the council have been, ever since, the council started to rely back on that, saying that we did have a say, but it was just a kangaroo court to make it appear that way.
I'm surprised they didn't just tell you to harden up, it's only a little bit of risk.
Well, that's exactly what David Kirkpatrick did say.
We can't make this stuff up, bro.
Well, I pointed out a scenario where cars had to reverse out of garages that were designed on corners of the road. They were reversing out blind into traffic on the intersections. And the commissioner said, well, maybe they can reverse into the garages and then they'll come out forward blind. And that's when I said, well, the city plan doesn't allow for that either. And that's when he said, well, you're going to get the community police there or something. So it was just a nonsense. He has since been promoted to be a district court judge, I believe.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure he's going to be really, really handy in that particular era of law enforcement, considering his track record, don't you think?
I think so, yeah. Well, to go on, there was worse things that happened there as things progressed. What happened after that was that the developer made an application to increase the size of the commercial area that feeds off this narrow road that they'd already built. And that increased the traffic volume from about 6,000 to 11,000 vehicles per day on this spine road that was already too narrow and unsafe. What staff did then to consent the increase in the commercial area, which obviously increased the traffic, almost doubled it, they went to a traffic engineer, two senior managers at the council. They went to a traffic engineer and said to him, look, can you review the whole of the road network around this commercial area? And this included roads and intersections up to a kilometre away. But they said, can you do that review of the road network, but don't review the specific bit of narrow spine road through here, which is the one that directly feeds the commercial area. They said, can you review the road network, but not review this narrow spine road? And the traffic engineer said, well, I suppose I can if that's what you want me to do. So anyway, later in the day, someone else from the council rung that traffic engineer and engaged him to do the safety review on the roads in relation to this commercial area. So he did that, and he didn't review that bit of spine road. But the report that the council staff gave to the commissioner stated that the traffic engineer had specifically reviewed that spine road. Are you hearing that? So what's happened there is that these council officers, two of them, went to the traffic engineer, told the engineer, do not review this road here, and then they told the commissioner that he had. Now, this is a road that was later given an independent safety order from Dr. Turner, a well-recognised traffic expert, and he revealed that there was 10 serious and significant safety issues with the road network through this subdivision.
How interesting. Would it by chance cost a lot of money in order to correct all of those small dangers that would fall upon the developers?
Well, they're actually large dangers. The serious and significant safety issues are deemed to be safety issues that cause frequent serious injury and death. So they're major safety issues that they identified. As far as remedying the roads, yes, they could be remedying. I provided a remedy to the council, which simply required insetting parking each side of the road that was built. There's still currently paddocks out here. So it's not a great issue to actually just indent parking outside of the carriageway that's built. That would allow for the required safety amenities to be brought back into the road, such as cycle lanes and the turning medians. They still wouldn't be quite up to standard, but they'd certainly be a lot safer than what they've currently got. With building narrow roads, they're obviously a lot cheaper to build. They didn't have the safety features in them, the indented parking, the medians, all the rest of it. So they're not only cheaper to build, but they also provide a lot more land for the developer to profit from in cutting sections up. No problem with developers making money, that's not a problem. But when it's at the risk of public safety and when there's risks of public life and injury at stake, it just doesn't cut it with me.
And this is part of your kind of professional background. Did you ever work at the council doing similar work, or is it just part of your nomenclature doing architecture?
As a designer, I've had a lot of experience in resource consenting, making applications to the council in relation to developments and housing. So I've got a good background knowledge of the resource management.
So if this was a court trial, you'd be considered an expert witness? You know, like a police witnessing a murder or a crime or something like that, who have an expert way of looking at it because they're experienced and they have the technical know-how.
Yes, I have been accepted in the Environment Court to give evidence in relation to minor traffic matters. So, yes, it is accepted that I have experience in that field.
Well, who benefits from ignoring your evidence that you're bringing forward?
Well, the benefit is the developer, and obviously I'm not sure what's happened between the developer and the council staff. But
what do you think happened? Do you have any allegations you'd like to put out?
It's a little hard to say. I can't understand how something that could have been fixed so easily at the start, because we raised this issue as soon as we saw it, and we were just staggered that whenever we pointed out an issue that could be easily resolved, there was just more and more bullshit thrown back at us. And the council just created this huge fight against us. It's cost myself and some other residents around here in excess of $60,000 fighting the council. The council were fighting against us to eliminate public cycle lanes and safety amenities. They were fighting against the community to not have these required safety elements. So effectively fighting against the community to steal away the amenities.
And this is before the earthquake, you say?
This is before the earthquake, and of course the earthquakes happened and it continued after that.
If anything, it probably continued and got worse.
Well, it did get worse. What happened was when we started exposing the faults, council staff started engaging lawyers to say they'd done nothing wrong.
How much money are these lawyers making? Because I recall up in the Occupy Auckland thing, the council lawyer that they had prosecuting Occupy Auckland, which amounted to nothing, cost them nearly $250,000 or something.
We'd be well over this in the council trying to consent these non-complying roads here.
So somebody's using it as a gravy train, and it's only in their best interest that you keep getting ignored, because that way they keep getting paid.
Well, I actually accused the lawyer from Simpson Grierson that the council engaged. I accused him of lying in a public council meeting. Bob Parker told me that I shouldn't use that word. I told him that if I didn't use that word, I'd be lying.
Sounds about right, eh?
Well, and then Bob Parker said,
No, remember, Sir Bob Parker said.
Well, he wasn't Sir at that stage.
Oh, well, now he is.
Right. But anyway, he then told me, well, I can't say that because they're not there to defend themselves. And I said, well, the lawyer is here to defend himself, and pointed to him. And I said, he can sue me if he likes. I'm quite happy. In fact, I'd like him to, because I can prove he's lying. And, you know, I can't afford to take him to court for lying. It's not my role to anyway. But certainly if he tries to sue me for defamation or whatever Bob Parker was warning me of, well, good luck to him, because I can prove he is a liar.
So in this respect, you've got... Let me just see if I've got all the elements in the equation here, because I've interviewed a number of people. Christchurch, before the earthquake, was a shambles, and it was corrupt, and basically you couldn't get anything done unless you had the right connections, and if you have the right connections, you can pretty much do anything, especially if you're a developer, especially if there's a lot of money involved. And then after the earthquake, it's only accelerated the process of corrupting any... fair hearings that people might have, and now people are in homes that are, you know, substandard and can't get their insurance payouts to boot, as well as having to deal with a corrupt council that won't even take responsibility for the things that they do.
Well, yes, the whole consenting debacle we had with building consenting, it's the same thing with the consenting roading here, and it's the same manager that was responsible for resource consenting and consenting these roads as it was with the buildings. He's since been promoted to the council. He's now their number one legal advisor to the acting chief executive.
Well, it seems to me in New Zealand political history that he who is most corrupt gets promoted the fastest because he's capable of making the most money for his corrupt doggy masters.
Well, I don't know how it works in there, but I've been disappointed with the elected council that were brought in to fix the systemic issues right through. They haven't done anything to... with either. I've put this evidence in front of them of senior managers going to traffic engineers telling them not to review roads that they knew were unsafe, and then advising the commission he had. I've told them about that. I've presented the evidence to the elected council, and they have failed to act. Now, I thought when Bob Parker's council was effectively dismissed that Leanne Dalzell's council would step up to the plate, but I'm starting to receive the same sort of problems there.
It's kind of like meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Well, yes, and except everyone's getting promoted up a notch.
Yeah, the worst. It's much like on a stagnant pond column. Where does the scum go? All the way to the top, and it sits there. It blocks out all the healing light from the sky, and everything beneath the layer of scum withers and dies and gets corroded.
Excellent. I like the way you put that. The community board's been the one shining light in this. Worked in Wigram Community Board under Mike Moore. They've been fighting very hard for the residents, but the elected council unfortunately aren't taking full notice of them either.
Mm. And I'm acting under the assumption that this is the first kind of, you know, unbiased media coverage you've gotten on this issue as well. We're not subjected to, like, maybe a 30-second soundbite or omission completely.
This is certainly the best chance I've had. CTV has had a bit of a look at it, but the press has been absolutely rubbish. They have done some articles on it, but they tend to favour the perspective of the developer.
It's probably because they're afraid of getting sued themselves. Because did you know that even if you sue somebody for no good reason or whatever, even if they're telling the truth, it'll still cost them X amount of dollars to defend the fact that they're telling the truth? And this is how the big corporate business scumbaggery in this country keep the media off their tails. Me, I'm just reckless and stupid. When they come after me, I'm screwed, but... You know, in the meantime, I'll do what I can.
Well, the problem I've had with the press is they tell me that we can't print the truth because it's corrupt. And I said, well, how can we get the truth out there? I said, I can't tell lies. I've got to tell you what the truth is. And they said, well, what you're saying is we can't publish. And I said, well, how are the public supposed to know what's going on?
Well, you listen know, to the Vinny Eastwood Show for one, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not joking.
Good on you. Brilliant, though. Good that you can bring these matters to light, and
I don't know, Colin. It's. I'm not sure how much I'm bringing to light, but the one thing I am certain of is that I'm capable of helping the people who are on independently on their own, bringing these things to light have a chance to actually express it. And even if nobody listens to it, it actually, I find it always feels better for the person to be able to at least say it and have somebody who's not bloody barking BS at you or making excuses or saying that, oh, it's just evil, you've got to accept it, you know, and being a frickin' slave.
You're spot on there, because it's a very hard battle because no one really cares. That's the issue. But they think, because they know it's so bad what I'm saying, they just, I don't know if they can believe it's true or they just don't want to. So they finish up just ignoring you.
Well, they've just got that cognitive dissonance, bro. It's like, oh, I've got my entire worldview that's been built up by going to university and high school and primary school and everything like that and watching television my entire life and watching mainstream media and listening to what they say on the radio. How could that all be incorrect considering it's packaged for me by the government and major mega scumbaggery corporations that own my entire life? You must be wrong instead of all the other things that are messing up my life for the entirety of my existence. You must be wrong. Therefore, I'm going to attack you instead of looking at reality.
Yep, that's about it.
Through their source of rejection of truth, it'll often basically put a huge weight on the shoulders of the people who are telling the truth, to the point where it'll either frustrate you, grind you to a halt, or realize that it's like triage on the battlefield. There's some people who you're just wasting your resources on that you can't save anyway. And you've got to just listen to the people and talk to the people who you can actually make a difference in their lives. Because I don't know about you, Colin, but I'm a student of history. And as far as I'm concerned, as far as I've seen, the only time when anything has ever changed for the better throughout history, it has not been the masses leading the way. It has always been one man or one woman who just says no, and all the other people just fall in line behind them eventually, but they usually only fall in line long after that person's had their life destroyed, their reputation dragged through the mud, and all of their resources and all of their social capital and everything's been thrown out. Only then do people fall in behind you, because then it doesn't cost them anything to do the right thing.
Yes, I can see your point there. That's why people like you need to get this message out, to help people like me.
Yeah, and if I might say so, Colin, people like you are the ones who do the quote-unquote real work in terms of exposing corruption in this country. I'm just a glorified radio jockey parakeet, more or less. My job's just to sit here, work the little levers of the machine, and make sure that voice of yours is amplified. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that, but basically, had there not been any work, suffering, research, council meetings and things of that nature, which you'd endured in order to possess this incredibly hard-won knowledge and experience, I wouldn't have a show, bro. So thank you very much for your contributions to it. And also thank you for your contributions to the country and, of course, Christchurch City, because I find that people like you are greatly underappreciated for the importance of the work that you do. You really are the glue that is actually holding the decent New Zealanders together from all of these corrupt scum that beset our nation. And I thank you, Colin.
Well, thank you.
You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood doesn't go ahead, make my news. This is a listener-supported broadcast predominantly, so please go to the homepage and either take through the Kiwi Bank account there, give us a monthly gift of whether that be 5, 10, 20. One guy does $100 a month gift to the show. I don't know what the heck his problem is. Maybe he just really hates scumbaggery and wants to see it exposed by any means necessary. I do. So go to the homepage. There's a bank account and PayPal buttons there as well for you to make your donations, and also regular gifts to the broadcast to make sure that we stay on air and keep doing the work that the mainstream media simply won't do. We will see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. And Colin, just quickly before we go, where exactly can people find you? Do you have a website or a blog or something of that nature where people can access the details in their entirety?
I'm a bit green on the internet and complex side, but there is a guy that's taken interest recently who has started a web page. If you googled Delamain, that's the adjoining subdivision, You'll find the details there. Delamain Action Group, I believe they're called. But there's a few details on that, so they may be able to find some more information out from that. Otherwise, I'm pretty easy to find. I'm in the phone book if people want to know more.
Are you on Facebook, or do you have an email you'd like to give out on here?
People can email me on Stokesy, S-T-O-K-E-S-Y, at extra.co.nz.
All right, there we go. Stokesy at extra.co.nz. If you're living in Christchurch or around the world, or if you just want to actually research into this a little bit, I'm sure Colin has large quantities of documentation on his computer and PDFs and all of that kind of stuff. people like you always keep documentation on freaking everything. That's why the council hate you so much, because they can't get away with it forever.
The good thing is that the new council under Leon Dalzell, they now tape all their council meetings, so there's actually video footage now too, which is good. If we had that under the previous council, that would have been very interesting with some of the information I presented to Bob Parker and his team.
Yeah, always have a recording device present. That's what my advice is. Whenever you're dealing with anybody in an official capacity, whether you're having a conversation with your lawyer, a police officer, a councillor, a politician, doesn't matter, have that stuff recorded, bro, because they'll always deny whatever they said if what they said implicates them in some kind of criminal activity.
Well, I actually have a policy in the council that they aren't allowed to admit liability or that they've made mistakes.
That doesn't sound dodgy at all. You know?
I had a few correspondences back and forward to the council lawyer, and I caught him out on three matters that he kept getting wrong, and I finally got him to the corner whereby he couldn't admit that he was wrong, but I'd proven it. So I actually asked him a question under the Official Information Act. I says, please accept you're wrong on this, or if you haven't got the ability to, because you're not allowed to, please admit that you don't have the ability to. So he said, well, yes, I don't have the ability to admit I'm wrong, but furthermore, I'm not. He had to say that he's not, because that's what he just admitted he had to say.
I've got four words for you, Mr. Lawyer. If you say so. Thank you very much, Colin Stokes, and we will see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.